Hey, I'm Saji Wickramasekara, and this is Transcribed, Benchling's podcast where leaders share their personal journeys and hard-won lessons driving scientific progress. My guest, Sarah Kankare Mitra, has seen it all. With a career spanning more than 25 years in R&D, Sarah's brought 15 drugs to market, led through breakthroughs and setbacks, and stayed curious and resilient through it all. Sarah, thanks for doing this.
Yeah, thanks for inviting me.
Let's get straight into it.
All right.
You spent 23 years at Genentech, ultimately as SVP of Development Sciences, and your track record speaks for itself. 15 drug approvals, over 100 IND submissions. Can we start with the story behind Kadcyla? Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Yes.
I heard it was a program that almost died, but you and a few others were able to bring it back to life, and it became the first antibody drug conjugate to treat solid tumors. What gave you, tell us the story of this medicine, and what gave you the conviction the drug was going to be successful, and how you convinced everyone else?
Yeah, no, happy to. So it's Kadcyla.
And
Kadcyla is a drug that is currently on the market and used to treat women with HER2-positive breast cancer. And at the time, and this would be probably around 2000.
Okay. Kind of midway through your Genentech
tenure. Yeah, I would say. And or maybe earlier part still of my tenure. You know, antibody drug conjugates is a field that's been around for a while. And many, many companies and people have tried to conjugate drugs to antibodies. And at Genentech,
So it wasn't a new idea at the time.
It wasn't an entirely new concept. It's just that nothing really much had come out of it. There was a few companies that were doing work, and we had a collaboration with Immunogen for their maytansine drug. And the idea there is you conjugate the drug to the antibody, and the antibody of our choice was a trastuzumab or a Herceptin-like antibody. And the idea was an elegant one. If you bring the maytansine and conjugate it to a trastuzumab antibody, you know, in treating women with HER2-positive breast cancers, these tumors that overexpress HER2, you'd get sort of a double whammy effect of the maytansine.
And at the time, what was the standard treatment for women who had that type of breast cancer?
Yeah, so Herceptin was already approved, right? And it had already changed the trajectory of women with HER2-positive breast cancer. So this would have been sort of like the next steps. And we were working on other drugs. There was Perjeta that was developed later by Herceptin, by Genentech and Roche. So here I was, you know, I just happened to get on the program. We had created a conjugate, and that was being tested in animal studies. And I was literally on the program for maybe 6 months or so when we found out that the safety of that molecule was awful. In fact, we had some really bad safety with that original molecule.
Okay, so this is your phase one.
This is preclinical.
Okay, so animal studies.
We haven't even gone into patients. And so the company basically said, well, this is too risky. And remember, all this while we had been working on monoclonal antibodies, which in general are much more safer. Not that they don't have side effects, but unlike small molecules or chemotherapy.
Sure, they're so specific.
They're so specific. And so this was a bit too much. And essentially, you know, management at the time didn't feel like they wanted to invest more. And this is where, you know, in fact, one of my colleagues, the famous Mark Slakowski, who is essentially a champion for HER2, myself and a few other folks, said, well, you know, we wanted to understand why we saw what we saw. And this is, I believe...
You couldn't explain...
We just couldn't explain it.
Okay.
We couldn't explain it. We were like, why would that happen? And instead of just shutting the program, we really believed that we had a hypothesis for why this was happening. And it related to the chemistry of the molecule, the stability of the linker, and things like that. And so we...
Conjugation itself, less the sort of premise.
The concept itself, right? So we said, like, we would love to try a little bit more before we throw in the towel. And originally, we got a lot of pushback. You know, there was no interest. No one wanted to do this.
And at the time, there's very few antibody drug conjugates on the market.
Very few on the market. So we then put up a quick proposal together and asked for a very finite amount of money, said very little, like, FTEs needed for this. Give us 6 months, and we wanted to test out a few of these experiments, and then we can see where we get. And it took a little bit of influencing, but we actually were able to convince management at the time to give us the 6 months, and it was very little money to allow us to get to those 6 months. And actually, the Kadcyl, two molecules came out of that of that 6 months, and one of them was Kadcyl.
What was the other?
It was a different analog. We had like a lead and a backup, and Kadcyl was the molecule that moved forward.
So the idea, like, change the chemistry and maybe the safety issues go away.
It went away. We were able to demonstrate by changing the chemistry that you actually could get rid of the safety issue without impacting the efficacy of the molecule. I mean, it was just incredible feeling for us to know that this could totally be a project that was a dead project. And here we were, we not only brought it back, we were really excited by the technological advance we had made. And at the time, we didn't know this would be a drug, but certainly it had passed a huge hurdle that then would allow it to be tested in patients.
When did you know it was going to be a big drug?
Yeah, I think that only came after the clinical studies in phase two, et cetera. And, you know, certainly what we were hearing from patients, from investigators, et cetera, was promising. And so when Kadcyl became a drug, which, as you know, in drug development, everything takes a very long time. From that time to, I cannot remember the exact year Kadcyl became a drug. It might be 2010 or 11. It's a ways off. But when you look back and you think about the journey and connect the dots from, you know, that one decision changes the trajectory.
You hadn't sort of pushed and said, hey, we want to run this, you know, one more experiment, 6 more months, small amount of money, like a drug might not have ever made it to the market.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
It makes you wonder how many other medicines like that could be sort of, you know, almost made it to the clinic, but, you know, could have transformed the lives of patients.
Yeah.
Was it a controversial decision to, like, revisit something with a bad safety profile? Do most programs, if the initial safety readouts pre-clinic are poor, do they just get canned at that point typically?
Yeah, I think it really depends. Genentech, you know, I mean, it was an amazing place to be, was very science-driven, right? And very data and evidence-based. I think it took some influencing, but the overall context of Genentech was very much about following the science. So I think as long as we came in with a very, you know, hypothesis-driven scientific approach to solving something, and it was Genentech. We did, you know, Genentech was taking a lot of risks and chances, and they allowed us to do that. So I think, yes, you're right. I think a lot of drugs can, you know, I'm sure there are drugs that never make it because people give up. I think that's why I always say this is an industry of guts and an industry of resilience, because you just don't know when you're taking a risk whether that risk will pan out, because the time frame is so long that you're not sure. But you have to take those risks with some conviction that even if you fail, you'll get up, you'll dust off, and you'll find a way forward.
Let's talk more about Genentech. So when you started, Genentech was just beginning to ramp up in cancer, its cancer program. And so under the leadership of Sue Desmond-Hellman, Genentech grew into this powerhouse in oncology. And, you know, Genentech built medicines which have impacted the lives of millions of cancer patients at this point. What lessons did you learn from Sue? Like, what was unique about her leadership style that helped put Genentech on the map in terms of cancer programs and scaling it up?
Yeah. You know, so firstly, I'll say, like, having Sue as a mentor and having her as a leader at the time that I was at Genentech was pretty special. I mean, Sue is a pretty special individual. It's clear from her resume and what she's done, of course, but even as a human being and as a person, she's very impactful. She's very accessible. She's very real. But I think I really admired a few of the qualities which many of us, not just me, try to mirror, try to learn from. And I think the few things that, you know, she was really good at, one is she had this true passion for patients. No matter what the topic was, no matter what the meeting was, no matter what the town hall was, she had this uncanny ability to connect back to patients. And she did it in such an incredible manner that I don't think I've seen anybody else do it since. And I know personally that it's not that easy to do, but she just had this ability to really center everything back to the patient. And we used to say science-based and patient-focused. She was the patient focused and also the science based, but really the ability to bring, you know, we would sit around the table to make decisions and you knew she'd be able to bring it back to the patient.
Interesting. So she was uniquely good at that. Because when you say it like that, it sounds so obvious, right? Because you're in the business of making medicines for patients. Yeah. But I'm guessing it's really easy to just get lost in the science or maybe the commercial aspects of medicines.
Totally. Because when you're making decisions, you know, you're looking at data and it just sounds like data and science. And as you said, commercial, you're talking about first in class and best in class. And somewhere in all of that dialogue, you just forget about the patient, right? Like it's the patients are there, but you don't like talk about them. But she, even like organizational decisions, she would stand at a town hall. It would be organizational. And yet she'd bring it back to the patients. And I think like for me, that was incredible to watch. And she did it in a very easy, pragmatic. It didn't matter what role you were in the company.
It was natural for her to bring it back to the patient every time.
And everyone, the most junior employee, the most non-science-based employee would be able to connect with what she was saying, which was just incredible.
That's got to be unbelievable for just alignment top to bottom across the entire company.
And very clean in a manner that that her thoughts were very clear and her ability to bring home the message was excellent. So that was number one, right? The second thing I really appreciated about her is decision-making. She was very clear about how decisions get made, who makes decisions. This, you know, Genentech had this single decision-maker model that really was important. We would always say, who's the decision-maker in this meeting, right? And Sue followed that. And when she was the decision maker, her decisions were very clean. And in other meetings, we always knew this person is the decision maker. So you can give all your feedback and all your perspectives, but ultimately that person makes the decision. And again, that clarity of decision making was something she brought to the table.
Interesting. So she was extra good at making sure it was clear who owned the decision and guiding a group to go and make the decision.
Yes. The third point that she did, which for me was also fantastic, is her interest in talent and her belief in growing leaders in the organization. So she like really went out of her way to mentor people, but also to create programs to spot talent in the organization and help them grow. And I feel I benefited from that.
So you were one of the people that Sue kind of spotted.
Yeah, I did. And I'm sure there were multiple others, but
What role were you in for when you sort of first got to know Sue?
Well, I was probably a director in the organization, you know, and she made time when I went to speak with her, et cetera. And she was always giving pearls of wisdom. I was part of a leadership program that was created to, you know, again, the people that were in that program, they're all in successful seats
they're
right
heads
now.
Heads of R&D, CEOs,
wherever they
CSOs,
are.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I think this ability to not only spot talent, to mentor them, to give them the path to grow. That also is incredible, you know. And I know she did that very well.
Let's talk about another famous leader from Genentech at that time. So, in 1995, it was a pretty controversial decision. Not controversial, but it definitely made waves when Art Levinson was named CEO. One shareholder quoted the Wall Street Journal, "Art is a fabulous scientist, but not, in my opinion, one who you would suspect could run this company." He went on, and obviously, you know, fabulous leadership team as well shares the credit to, you know, turn the company around, 13 new FDA approvals over 14 years, you know, winning numerous awards like America's Best CEO, you know, very much looked at as like a revered figure in biotech today, like, and also one who's someone under the radar you don't hear a lot about today. Like, what's so special about his leadership, and how has that influenced your style as a leader?
Yeah. And you know, Art actually was all of that, right? Like, he was a very understated, typical scientist.
He started as a scientist at Genentech,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, and he walked around as a scientist at Genentech, and I don't think he ever took off that cape as a scientist. He added,
even when he was CEO.
Even when he was CEO.
You felt like he was a scientist.
100%. But of course, he added all of the other capes, which is the business hat on and all of that. But he never let go of the scientific hat.
Yeah.
So that's an important thing. A few traits that I remember, and I'm sure there were many more, but as I was a junior scientist in the organization, and as I grew through
when he
the
became
organization,
CEO.
When he became a CEO, I think that he...
Were people surprised when he became CEO?
You know, he was already the CEO when I joined the company. At the time, he already was someone that people were respecting. So I can't comment on the surprise factor, but I can tell you that he used to attend all of the scientific reviews. Even while he was CEO, he would come to the research review committee. He would be sitting in those meetings, which is where I got the firsthand, you know, experience of what Art Levinson was.
Yeah. Wow.
And I think the first thing I noticed is that he used to say this, you know, whenever he brought leaders together and spoke to them, he would say, because he was very much a sort of a shy, introverted kind of a person. But what he would say is, he would say that he expects that all leaders that are in senior roles are paying, you know, like they are spending a lot of time thinking about the bigger picture and the strategy and all of that, but they know all the details. And that was something he expected. I could see that that's how he operated. And I think that that was a model in which most leaders at Genentech operated also, which is like, you do have to get your hands wet and you do have to, you know what's going on in the science and what's, you know, the details of the experiments and how people are thinking through it. He sat in our meetings and his uncanny ability was to just ask the most astute questions.
Okay. So he's very Socratic in his approach.
Very. The type of questions that perhaps nobody wants to ask, he would ask them. Now, of course, he was the CEO of the company.
It's an interesting dynamic, because if he's sort of asking scientific questions in a review, people are probably going to defer to him also more than other people.
Yeah. But he just was one among others, you know, and he did it with a lot of respect. So there are people who can ask questions which make you sound like you are dumb.
Yep.
Particularly if they are themselves very educated, they know a lot, they're a fantastic scientist, which Art was. But he asked it in extremely respectful manners. It almost came across as someone that's just really curious about this question.
I love that.
So, right? And that, I think, was his ability of making everyone, and people liked that. People just liked Art. He was one of everyone. And he also called out BS all the time. So I have numerous memories of him sending emails to the entire company when he saw things.
Tell me about one.
Yeah. So, for example, there was a time when people started using words that were just out of the common vocabulary, and which he really bugged him. It bothered him a lot. And he said, you know, every meeting I sit in, people use words like leverage
corporate speak
is coming in.
Yeah.
So he invented a game called Buzzword Bingo. And he sent an email to everyone and he said, I've invented this game. It's called Buzzword Bingo. Anytime you're in a meeting, if you hear a buzzword, I suggest you stand up and say bingo. And for the number of words that you do that for, there'll be an award at the end of it. That was hilarious. I mean, I was just like laughing
and
when I saw
Genentech
this email.
Is how many thousands of people at this pool?
Thousands of people at that time. Definitely in the 8,000 to 10,000 at that
and
time.
And I'm sure some of the senior most executives are probably the guiltiest of,
of
buzzword bingo.
Yes. And of course, you know, as we were commercializing and, you know, the language just was changing from a very science to, you know, having much more of corporate business aspects. Now, it was fun for a while. We all laughed. I saw a number of meetings where people did the bingo thing. But the reality was that he brought attention to something that he cared about, the culture of the organization. Like, he didn't want the culture to shift. So here he was. And like, he, what I heard was, this wasn't like someone in communications helping him. He literally would sit and write that email.
And send it to the whole company.
You know, he did this on other occasions where he just said, he would call up. For example, there was one time where he said, there are way too many consultants that people are using. I think this is ridiculous. You're beginning to now depend on, you know, let me bring in a consultant. So he came up with a policy where in a slide deck, you had to actually say no consultants used. So if you went to the executive committee and gave a presentation, you had to have a proper disclosure statement.
These ideas are mine, not a consultant's.
Yes, yeah. Yes. So that was art. And I think he did those things because he really cared about the culture. So he took the culture so seriously. And again,
I mean, people still talk about the culture of Genentech during that era today.
And incredible.
It's been decades, right?
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes. But he was kind of fearless in that regard. Like, he it mattered so much that he didn't think twice. He needed to let the company know, like, this is not what I want. And I think that's exceptional. I think that
people
it was
for clarity from their leaders.
They got clarity, you know, and he made it fun through games and things like that. But it was like basically him saying, this is important, pay attention.
I think it'd probably be pretty hard pressed to find sort of CEOs amongst the largest pharmaceutical companies in the world sitting in on every single scientific review meeting. Like, that's
totally
very unusual.
Very unusual. Yeah.
What
very
do you think
unusual.
Stopping more scientists from becoming CEOs?
Yeah, you know, I think, again, the perception, like you read, I'm sure the perception is that scientists don't have the sort of the necessary business knowledge, et cetera, particularly as a company's commercializing and those
sure.
things become important. I bet that becomes a factor in how CEOs get chosen, right? It's the market that demands it. But there are lots of examples
yeah.
of CEOs
it's
that
changing.
Were scientists, and it's changing. And so I think that Art is certainly a great example of a very, you know, atypical, like, he wasn't an extroverted person. He still loved wearing his Hawaiian shirt and his jeans. I still recall William Blair was the prime minister of England, and he came for a visit, and I cannot remember what the event was, but he was in the US and he came to Genentech, and it was a big deal. William Blair's coming,
prime minister of the
prime
company. That's
minister
pretty big deal.
Visiting
yeah, yeah.
And so we all were on the building rooftops, and we were looking down as his motorcade, because they had shut all the streets, and his motorcade comes in, and he steps off and he's walking towards the building, and we see someone going to him in a suit. And most of us didn't recognize that was Art.
It was, you'd never seen him in a suit before.
We had never seen him in a suit. And we kept wondering, like, is this the one time ever that Art Levinson wears a suit?
Leader of a nation state
yes.
visits, put a suit on. Okay. Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah.
In an industry where only 1 in 10 drug candidates succeed, you know, failure is just inevitable. It's the reality of the business. You know, you've talked about failing fast, failing early. Can you give an example of where a failure felt like a win or resulted in a critical insight later on that led to great, great progress?
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, you know, as our industry is all about failures, you know, in fact, even now when I see people in my organization, whenever there's a failure, they get very disappointed. But I almost presume that 9 out of 10 times it's a failure. So I go in knowing that it's going to be a failure. But oftentimes in science and in biotech, no failure is a complete, a failure where you don't learn something from it. I think pretty much in every situation, you learn something either about the biology, about the science, about the drug you developed. Whether you decide to pursue something later, that's a different issue. That could be a business decision or a strategic decision. But you always learn something. If nothing else, you learn that you didn't make the right drug, or you made the right drug, you didn't make it with the potency you wanted, or you made the right drug with the potency you wanted, but you cannot give it in the doses that you wanted. or you were just not hitting the right target, you know, and you will still understand it. I think the one example that comes to mind for me, it's a drug called lebrikizumab that was originally developed by, actually it was a drug that Genentech in-licensed from Tanox.
Okay. That's a name I haven't heard in a while, Tanox.
Yeah, and it was a IL-13 antibody. And my team was very involved in the development of this drug. And lebrikizumab was being developed for treating asthma. Okay, and that was just the first indication we knew that IL-13 had a role in number of inflammatory immune sort of conditions. So the first indication was asthma. We had already, we had gone through phase one. I believe the phase one was done by Tanox. So we started doing the phase two. We had also had two phase three studies. And what happened in those phase three studies is one of them was successful and one of them were not. They were identical phase three studies.
Huh.
And it happens in drug development. It was one was positive and one was
for you. Yeah.
Statistics, right? So Roche, at the time, we also had started studies in other indications. And one of the other indications was atopic dermatitis. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, at Genentech, we were so invested in lebrikizumab. These were pretty big studies we had done. We had spent a lot of time thinking through the manufacturing and all of this stuff. And then it was hugely disappointing to get to this point. At this time, Roche had already, merged with Genentech. And then there was a decision, there was an out-licensing decision that was made where Roche and Genentech out-licensed lebrikizumab to a company called, I think it's Dermira, mm-hmm. Which then got bought by Eli Lilly.
Okay.
And actually turned out that lebrikizumab did go into, so we had done some work with atopic dermatitis. It looked promising. They actually took it into phase three and it turned out to be a fantastic drug.
Wow.
And is today on the market as a drug for treating atopic dermatitis.
Huh. So you question decision-making at the phase two?
Yeah. You know, I think I actually think the I think the phase three decision was the right decision because, you know, your data was mixed in one trial and the other. There's no way you can go file in asthma for that. We would not have had the foresight to go into atopic dermatitis because asthma was the type of indication Genentech wanted to go into. But I'm glad we did some of the atopic dermatitis work to actually show that there is, you know, promise there, which allowed, you know, Dermira and then Lilly
to win for patients.
So this is a great example of where you think something is a failure, and even though you don't take it forward, ultimately it's a good thing for patients. So I really appreciate, you know, every time I see lebrikizumab, you know, out there as a Lilly drug, it brings a smile to my face because I know that we had a huge hand in getting it to that point, even though we didn't take it to atopic dermatitis and we didn't make it a drug at the end of the day.
Yeah. Let's talk early career. So a lot of your early training was actually in the small molecule world, right? As a pharmacology fellow at UCSF, so in academic medicine, and you know, even earlier I heard you were an intern running QA tests on fresh pressed tablets at one point. And then over time, like antibodies and other large molecules became a huge part of your repertoire. Like talk about that like journey, first of all, and also what it was like going from kind of one type of modality in science to something completely different that you didn't even train in.
Yeah. So, you know, my original training has been in classical medicine. You know, I was a student doing a pharmacy in India. And that's when I, as an intern, I was at Parke Davis, which, you know, was a company at one time. I don't know if you remember the name. And this is where I interned in making tablets and, you know, formulation and things like that. And when I did my graduate degree, it was still related to small molecules. And again, in my postdoctoral training, as well as my fellowship, most of the drugs I got exposed to were small molecules.
Okay.
But
Biologics probably weren't really that. I mean, there were monoclonal antibodies approved, right? But biologics were a very small part of the pipeline.
I will say that when the reason I came to Genentech is the reason I even saw Genentech as a name. One was because I was in the Bay Area and I loved being in the Bay Area. But the second was that there was a news article that was in the San Francisco Chronicle which described, it was a full page article that described the approval of Herceptin. And it said something like, the magic bullet for women with HER2 positive breast cancer. Okay. And
that's not an overstatement.
Yeah. It wasn't. Yeah. And it just caught my eye. And I thought, wow, you know, because all throughout my education with pharmaceuticals and with medicine, this idea of small molecules was, you know, sort of non-specific. There's always, you always benefit and risk is a big issue. And here we were talking about something that's so specific. I knew nothing about monoclonal antibodies at the time. And it just struck with me. Firstly, the concept that you could go treat women with a very specific type of tumor.
Which we totally take for granted today, by the way.
Yeah. We take it for granted. But at that time, this idea that, and particularly because it said that women that had this type of cancer had the worst prognosis among women with breast cancer. And now you've got a drug that is so specific to the HER2 protein. I thought that was fantastic. So when I went to Genentech, you know, the job I went into was as a small molecule, person. I was in the small molecule department. Genentech did have a small molecule group. They had chemists that were making molecules, and we did have a few small molecule programs. But I was intrigued by the monoclonal antibodies. And so when I first got an opportunity to get on a program that was a monoclonal antibody program, I grabbed it. Even though I was part of the small molecule group, I really said, like, I want to do this. They were looking for one of the PK scientists that could come and help on one of those programs. And I said, well, I'll do it. And the reason was that I was just intrigued. I knew nothing about large molecules. How do you make them? What's unique about them? How do you study them? And that took me down the path of monoclonal antibodies and then into ADCs, the antibody drug conjugates, et cetera.
There's very good career advice in there about following your curiosity and maybe not even being focused on the exact role you have at first and like just being on like the winning team that you think is the right one to be a part of.
Yes. I think learning is really important, right? And I've always, even when I did Strength Finders earlier in my life career, I noticed that learning came out as the top three strengths. And that's, again, comes back to curiosity. Like when I want to understand something, I'm going to follow it. I'm going to try and learn. I'm going to surround myself with people that know a lot about it. And what a wonderful place to be at Genentech. Like I kept thinking, what a shame that I'm at Genentech and I know nothing about the thing that the whole world is talking about, right? So all I did was just learn from people around me. I mean, there were so many smart people at Genentech. You just had to spend time with them and start working with them. And before you know it, they were teaching you.
Yeah. How much did you know about neurotherapeutics before you joined Alector?
I knew a little bit, but not too much. So I've worked on about, I think, like 3 or 4 programs at Genentech. So Ocrevus for multiple sclerosis, that's something that we worked on. And before that, there was at least 2 or 3 other programs.
Talk about the decision to go run R&D at Alector, because, I mean, you're an expert in the field at this point. You got multiple medicines approved. Neuro is a category that, you know, at the time was probably not a very loved category.
Yeah.
And so there's probably a lot of reasons not to do it.
Yeah.
And you still chose to do it. And tell us about that.
So I think, you know, for me, that decision had 2 parts to it. The first was the what, you know, what do I want to work on, right? I knew that I was looking to, I'd reached a point at Genentech that I was looking to grow further. Question was, what is growth? And growth doesn't always have to be in this direction.
Sure.
Growth is, what is going to make me excited about getting out of bed every day and following. So, you know, the idea, I'd been in R&D the whole time. I was exposed to and learned every part of R&D. And by being at Genentech, essentially I'd been in every therapeutic area other than cardiovascular probably. Sure. So I could have gone in multiple different directions. I also, because of all the work that my team did in spearheading diagnostics and biomarkers, really all these relationships with between diagnostics and pharma, you know, I spent a lot of my time on all of this.
And incredible breadth at this point.
Breadth was very high. So there were multiple directions I could go. There were two things that happened. One is I knew that I wanted to be in the role that leading R&D. So a decision that I had made was I wanted to be the head of R&D because to actually have final accountability for that was something that I wanted to challenge myself with. I was confident I could do it just because I'd seen it all and I'd been part of it all, but I never was the final decision maker on all of it. So this was number one. So I decided I'd had to be a head of R&D role. The second thing was that the area, I could very well have gone into oncology because a majority of my career was in oncology. I also think that in the 24 years almost at Genentech, we changed the face of oncology. We really did. I mean, it went from an area where there weren't enough drugs for patients to an area where there's
the area.
Not only that, you know, not just from a pharmaceutical perspective, but from a diagnostic perspective, really being able to have comprehensive profiling of tumors and then, you know, connecting tumor types with drugs, all of that. Like I was part of all of that. Now, neuro, on the other hand, I thought was an area which the unmet need was still significant.
Massive.
Massive.
Yeah.
I mean,
total graveyard
I read the statistics on this. You know, I think there's something like 50 million people that worldwide, the World Health Organization, according to them, 50 million people worldwide with dementia right now, which is going to triple by like 2028.
Yeah.
Okay.
Huge looming problem.
Huge looming. If you look at the number of people over the age of 60 worldwide today, one out of every six has Alzheimer's disease or risk for Alzheimer's disease. Okay.
And obviously probably the bulk of all healthcare costs go towards this.
Towards this. It's a big, massive, and it's an aging population. And then on top of that, whether you take, and neuro is actually pretty large. I mean, we are only talking about this section of neurodegenerative disease, but there's ALS, there's Parkinson's. And then if you include neurologic disorders in children and growing adults, it's a huge problem. And so
very unknown.
Very
few successes.
And as you pointed out, high risk, extremely high risk. There really aren't any drugs. I mean, there were people who said to me, why are you even going into neuro? But, you know, that is precisely the reason I wanted to go into neuro, because there's a huge opportunity to make a difference. I'm not saying that I necessarily will be the person to make that difference. But even if I chipped away at it, it would be a pretty huge thing.
Sure, it's so much further behind something like oncology. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, the ability to actually, the chance that something works and you can actually, like, that changes the field could be huge. And so this is why I decided that I needed to be in a field where the field was open to disrupt and to make a difference. And this is the two reasons why I decided on Electro. The third is the people there. I really like the people there. Culture and people mattered to me. So,
I mean, through the 2010s, so many of the large pharma companies basically got into neuro, but then got out. And, you know, a little bit, you know, recently, I would say the sector, the area is beginning to see a bit of a renaissance. Yeah. Like, what's driving the increased optimism? What are the reasons to believe that we'll see advancements in neurodegenerative diseases in the next, you know, decade? Is it science? Is it technology?
Yeah, it's a combination, I believe. So, you know, clearly, I think there's a lot more known about the genetic underpinnings of the disease, and you're seeing a lot about targets that, you know, genetic risk profiles indicate that certain targets are critical in whether it's Alzheimer's or Parkinson's, et cetera. And there is a lot of, there are a lot of institutions that, like whether it's the Michael J. Fox Foundation for Parkinson's and others that are really pouring into learning what these risk factors are, right? So that's number one. one. Number two is that technologies. I mean, I think the number of drug modalities, we were just talking about small molecules and antibodies, but now, you know, whether you've got gene editing, you've got siRNAs and oligos, and, you know, there's this bigger repertoire of technology, right? The third thing is biomarkers, you know, whether it's imaging biomarkers or variables or fluid biomarkers. I think the understanding and the number of those biomarkers has grown in the last decade or two. So
I'm guessing the 2010s, like the, you know, if you're going to run a trial with any of these disorders, like what are like the endpoints for it? You have very little to measure against.
That's
right.
That's a huge problem. It's a huge problem, and even if you measure to know which ones are actually predictive of the outcome, that's a big challenge, right? But you have way more of that now, so there's tractability in your clinical development plan. And then finally, I think that in general, the regulatory agencies have also shown more flexibility. Recently there's been approvals, of course, of lecanemab and donanemab, but also tofersen, which is a drug for ALS, whether it's the use of surrogate biomarkers for approval, et cetera, has improved. And so I think that also adds to the excitement that's growing in the neuro area.
So maybe to the more layperson such as myself, like what's changed about the regulatory posture?
Yeah,
so some of these neuro,
I think there's been particularly for smaller, rarer neuro indications, there's been a greater appetite to really, of course, science back, but to look at biomarkers as surrogates for approval.
I see.
Rather than having a clinical endpoint, for example, to get approval based on a biomarker that's been clinically validated in some other form. So, for example, in registries, et cetera, where there's a close correlation between the biomarker and the clinical endpoint.
So going from a company, when you left Genentech, probably 13,000 employees, maybe more, to I'm guessing Alector was 200 people.
Yeah.
Okay. I imagine that's a huge adjustment in terms of, I mean, one, company culture. You probably knew every person at Genentech. You know how the whole organization worked top to bottom. You'd been there while it was built up, you've been part of that, to a much younger organization with different ways of working.
Yeah.
So you've been at it a few years. Like, what lessons can larger companies learn from smaller companies from larger ones? Like, tell me about the first entry into Alector after being at Genentech for 23 years.
No, this is fascinating. So I obviously have spent a lot of time thinking about this. I'm really glad I made the move, because even though I started at Genentech in the late 1990s, and I thought it was a small company at the time, it was already like 3,000 employees, which is a pretty large company.
You went to Genentech from UCSF?
From UCSF.
Okay, cool.
And so,
the first company you worked at. That's good picking.
Yeah. And so, even though I thought it was small, it really wasn't that small. It had already been through the paces of being a small company. So when I came to Alector, I didn't have quite the experience of being in a small company like that. A few things as I look back that small companies, it's almost like by necessity, do really well, which would be amazing if larger companies pick up on. So first is just the speed of decision making, right? The speed at which you make decisions, and you don't always have all the data, and you maybe have 80-20, and you make your decisions. And you make those decisions, you take the risk, and you take the risk with the idea that it's better to move forward than to stand in place.
Hmm.
See, and I think in larger companies,
It's easy to stand in place.
It's so easy to stand in place. And so there's a lot of analysis that happens and paralysis that happens. And teams swell a lot. There are a ton of committees, and months go by, and before a decision gets made. So the efficiency of decision making is incredible in small companies. In fact, I had to almost like
learn
shocked?
That.
I was shocked. I was shocked at the speed at which one makes decisions. I started to enjoy it very quickly, because I thought, okay, I get it, right? Like, this is amazing now, because I was so trained to spend that amount of time that, you know, it is a bit of an adjustment.
How long did it take you to kind of unlearn that?
Yeah, I think it took me at least 6 months before I kind of like could feel like, oh, you know, I
just
okay.
do this thing.
I just do it, you know, and you know, you learn, you make mistakes and you say, well, okay, well, you learn. So that's number one. Number two is the constraints are completely different. I mean, in a large company, we just talked about, you have a portfolio, you have millions of dollars. And sometimes you work, there are programs that are happening even beyond the portfolio. There's
sure.
so much happening that, you know, there's what I call a lot of fluff in the organization.
Sure.
After coming to a smaller organization, which was far more focused, you know what the programs are. Every person in the company is like completely dedicated to those programs. Everyone knows what the goals are, and you can account for pretty much everyone's time. I think that that incredible focus that you see in smaller companies, if you could even have half of that in a large company, it would be incredible.
Did you know when you were in Genentech, did you know about the fluff, or did you feel resource constrained? We don't have enough people to do everything we want. Like, cause it's easy to get that mentality in large organizations.
Yeah,
you never talk to anyone in a large organization who says, oh yeah, we got plenty of people.
Oh no.
Yeah.
Yeah. People always complain that we were resource constrained, always. And, you know, we were always complaining about our budgets and always complaining about our resources. No, in smaller companies, you can, you know, the other thing is that you also know that you can actually get a lot more done because of the focus and because of that intense mission orientation, you actually get a lot done. So I think the speed of decision-making, I also learned about this, you know, how do you work under constraints and you make the decisions and sort of the ability to pivot very quickly. So let's say you did something and it didn't work and you want to change around. It doesn't take months to change. Whereas in a large company, sometimes it's like moving the Titanic. You know, you keep doing a lot of
arm degrees movements. At a time.
It barely moves maybe a degree. Whereas in a small company,
you know, overnight.
You just turn overnight. You're like, okay, done. Made decision made. Let's move on to the next thing, right? I think that agility that you see in small companies, it's incredible. And it allows you to change course, to pivot, to dust off and move on. So the other thing is just the resilience I see, you know, and given I'm this person who always believes in resilience.
I was going to ask about that because no one program will sink or large or make it won't. No one program makes or breaks a large company,
right.
But it can totally happen.
It totally
biotech.
Can happen.
Yeah.
It totally can happen.
Was the organization already resilient? How do you prepare and teach resilience and get people to embrace failure in a smaller biotech?
Yeah. So I'm still on a journey. I don't have all the answers there. I'll say that that's exactly the question that I grapple with every day. Like, how do you make the organization, it's not just we, how do we make the organization resilient? You know, and resilience is something that you build with experience, right? Like, you know, you build the confidence that no matter what happens, that, you know, companies go through all phases. They go up, they come down. But when you go down, you have the ability to come up again. And that's exactly when resilience comes into the picture. And that can come with experience. Now, what you see in today's world is, you know, unfortunately, sometimes you see, particularly the younger generation, haven't had that experience of resilience.
Haven't experienced the adversity. Yeah.
Yeah. Adversity and how do you sort of rise from adversity? And so what happens is that their reactions are very raw. They also might just get up and leave and do other stuff and versus just sticking it out, you know. So I often talk about sticking it out and, you know, waiting because again, our field is a long game. Right? Like when I had that experience with Kadcyla, I didn't know it was going to be a drug. But I stuck with it. The company stuck with it. It allowed it the time to become a drug. So you know, making decisions today about like, you know, where you want to be or not want to be based on a very limited scope wouldn't be the right thing to do. But teaching that is not easy. I think the best way you can do it is to model it to yourself and make sure others see that you remain excited, that each, in fact, failures are opportunities that you need to be embracing. And because those opportunities can lead you to better days tomorrow. So,
is there anything the smaller biotech startups should learn from the larger companies?
Yeah. I mean, I think that the smaller biotechs tend to cut corners a lot, right?
Okay.
There's a scrappiness, which is a strength, but also sometimes can be a weakness because they want to be like the larger company in terms of the quality of a package, et cetera, but they may never get there. And so, being able to, sometimes I've seen smaller biotechs that they may not respect the depth that comes out of a large company. But there is depth. There's a lot of depth in large companies. There's process and there's waste and there's fluff. But there is also a lot of depth, incredible amount of depth and experience. And I think the small companies can benefit from that experience and might want to embrace it, knowing that it comes with a bit more, let's say the person might have a process orientation. I've seen other people that come from larger companies. They tend to have this process mindset rather than the project mindset. And so they
project mindset.
I think that larger companies, as companies scale and they become bigger, leaders tend to spend more time on the process rather than on the actual work.
Yeah.
Right? I think it's the nature of scaling. Even the brightest minds I've seen in larger companies tend to spend more time. They become process leaders. Like how do you take X from X to Y, right? And I think there is something that leaders have to watch out for. If they're spending more of their time talking about the process.
Like how the work is done than the work itself.
The work itself. I think it's a warning sign and it's time to, you need process. Process is very helpful, but it should be in service of rather than becoming the thing.
Oh, wow. That's fascinating. That's probably like a good, for any advice for anyone going from large company to small is to like check yourself on that.
Yeah, check yourself. And I've seen a few people that kind of come with that process mindset. Most people adjust very quickly. They know, and they actually love it and I love it too.
Quite freeing,
I love
right?
the fact, it's like, so freeing.
No one gets out of bed every day to like work on process.
And it's so freeing because you spend your time thinking about the program, you think about what could be done and you're always like kind of dealing with that. I feel that even in my role as president of the company, 99.9% is spent.
Science
and thinking about programs and thinking about, even when I'm thinking about people, it's in context of the program and what they're going to do. That's really exciting. And I hope if large companies could do that, I think even if they could tweak a little bit, it would make a difference.
And maybe for the smaller companies who want to recruit that experience from larger companies, they have to find the people who are really motivated and excited to get back to this project and not the process.
Yes.
I think if you go get the wrong person from a large company, it's probably tissue rejection for a startup.
Totally.
You've shared that you paused your career at one point for family responsibilities and almost didn't even join Genentech.
Yes.
Many say it's very hard to return to science after stepping away, but you came back, you thrived and became a super successful, well-respected leader. Like, how did that pause shape your views on company culture, on work-life balance, and on hiring?
Yeah. So this was very early in my career before I went to Genentech that I had to take a couple of years off, and it was a necessity. So there wasn't really an immediate choice. But I thought this is the end of my science career, and people said that to me. And this was in the late 1990s, before I went to Genentech, mid to late 1990s. And so people thought, this is it. I decided this is it. I don't think I'm ever coming back because there's no way anyone would would take me back with that break. Wasn't true. In fact, when I got a call from Genentech towards the tail end of that 2.5 years, someone who had a role open had been looking for me. They had called up UCSF and they said, well, she's on a sabbatical right now, but you can call her. And so they asked me to come in for an interview. I hadn't prepared myself, but it was out of the blue, and I thought, okay, well, I'm just going to go and have this interview. I don't know if I'm ready to get back into the workforce.
Only one way to find out. Yeah.
Only one way to find out. I did the interview. I had to actually give, you know, it was funny thing is that you have to give a presentation as a scientist. And I had not looked at a single scientific presentation or talked about anything in 2 years.
Okay. So you were fully family oriented two years.
Yes, yeah. I was a mother, and I had to do that, and I literally completely cut off. So I had to dust off my slides.
Is it like riding a
practice bike? Practice it, like riding a bike, and give the presentation. And I wasn't sure, but I got the job. Like literally in a few days, they called me and said, "You have the job." And I made the decision to get back to take that job, which was also very hard because, again, I had transitioned off, and coming back in was not that easy. But I did. And so I think that for me, this, number one, it's you know, it's about appreciating that there is always so much going on with an employee or a person
that
you're
not
aware of,
yeah.
That you're just not aware of. Mm-hmm. And to think of people in their whole being and their whole self, right? I think what was important to me is also that when I came to work, I gave it my 120%. Like company got the best out of me. And there was simply, you know, no secondness about it. And I kept everything else behind the curtain, so to speak, mm-hmm. right? And I think about that when I talk about to employees, myself and my whole career, my team members, people. I think it, in fact, that experience made me a more empathetic and compassionate leader. I'm still very pragmatic and realist, but at the same time, you know, understanding that people, work-life balance means different things to different people. And you have to be able to hear people out and accommodate them. I believe that people will go above and beyond if you can understand that balance and if you can, you know, help them attain the goals. So.
You've talked about that leaders should spend about half of their time mentoring individuals on their team and help them grow. What are some of the most common weaknesses you see or areas to improve for early in career scientists, and how can they fill those gaps?
Yeah. So I think that particularly these days, you know, early in career scientists, there is a level of impatience that I see.
Did you have that impatience when you were in early?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I don't think so. I was always curious, and I went after things because I was learning, but not that I was impatient to get somewhere. Like, you know, there's an impatience of going from point A to point B rather than impatience of learning something while I'm in point A.
So I see.
It wasn't that I'm not an impatient person, but my impatience was was a different impatience.
It
was like, how can I learn about antibodies? How can I learn about that clinical development? How can I learn about manufacturing? But that's impatience, but that's not impatience of like being at this role and now tomorrow I need to be at that level. And I see that a lot more in early career scientists right now. The number of conversations I have with young scientists where I say, literally repeat the same thing, build depth. For me, mastery of the subject that, you know, you're, whether you're a drug developer or whether you're a tech developer, whatever it is, the mastery of the subject is so important. And it could be anything. It could be in accounting. It could be, but you better be like the best in that area. That's my personal mantra, you know, and I think that once that's solidified, everything else can be
It'll
built on top
place,
of that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so when someone is early in career, but they're already rushing to be like vice president of this or run a team of X, it's good to have those things in mind. But if your foundation is not solid, then it's a house of cards. It's just going to come down at some point. And so I think for me, what I try to mentor people is around, and that's not something that they like to hear because it also means you have to spend a lot of years building that, you know, that depth, because it's not going to come in a day. You also need the stick factor, the stick with it factor, right?
Mm-hmm. So you talked about stick with it factor, yeah.
The stick with it factor means you can't just get into a job for a year and then go find another job for a year and then go find another job for a year. Yeah, that may look on your resume. You might be, say, I've been at three companies, but what did you really achieve?
Like, great things take time.
Good things take time. And, you know, did you really get, you know, get the experience? Did you really see something go from A to B? Did you have many failures? If you didn't, then you really haven't built the resilience and the experience. So that's what I talk to. I don't think it always lands well, I'll be honest with you. But I think that that's my gift to tell the truth. And if even one person believes in it and learns from it, I think that would be a positive, yeah.
There are probably many times in your career where you've been the only female leader in the room. You've even been told things like, you need to change your personality, become more aggressive and loud. Like, what was that like? And, you know, the environment's obviously changed, probably presumably for the better, but like, what challenges remain?
Yeah, it's so true. You know, early in my career, this was very much the case where I would be the only female leader in the room. And it's very true that I was told that you need to adjust your style to fit in and things like that,
and
which
I
didn't.
Too. There's like a, you know, Art's quoted, you know, they're bringing five times as many men as women in leadership roles at Genentech, and that also changed.
So, it's important, you know, my lessons from that time, like today, it's not an issue. I mean, you know, everywhere you look, I think women that have something to contribute are at the table. And, you know, I think like we've really made a difference over the years. I mean, we're not there yet, but I think we've made a huge difference. You know, women are in leadership positions. What gives me the most pleasure when I see that is authenticity. And, you know, when I was told, like, let's say, change your style, be more aggressive, be more loud or whatever, I really had to pause and ask myself if that's something I wanted to do. And I didn't. I actually did the opposite, which is to say, well, I need to help the room to also adjust to me. And I think that the more I see people being their authentic self, whether it's a female, whether it's a, it could be anything, you know, just being themselves and bringing their authentic self to the table and then being influential. I think that's to me a true metric of success.
So. You've wanted to be in medicine for a long time. It sounds like you had a physician grandfather who came before you came to the U.S. for grad school, and then you know, you climbed the whole ranks of R&D and became a leader. Like, anything you change about your journey? What advice would you give to a young Sarah?
Yeah, no, I wouldn't change a thing. Actually, I'm amazed, and you know, really, I have a lot of gratitude for my journey. I don't think I designed the journey, and I think that, again, I followed my path with curiosity, one step at a time. I think I followed the tenets that I believe in. As I said, you know, be curious, try to learn from everyone. You're not the smartest person in the room. And
science is a very humbling profession like that.
It's extremely humbling.
Always
profession.
Surrounded by very brilliant people.
Yes. And you know, be a seeker of sort of knowledge. You know, I think that will take you places, right? So I when I look back, I have no regrets on my career path in any way. I've asked myself sometimes, should I have made the move earlier from Genentech, right? But there's never the right time. Like, I also, you know, I was also still continuing to have impact, and that's important. And then I'm thrilled that I've made this career change, or not career change, but the move later on in my career. But I wouldn't change a thing. I would have loved to have been a physician when I was younger. But looking back, I'm glad I took this journey, which continued to keep me in medicine, you know?
Amazing. Thank you so much for sharing,
Sarah. Of course.
I have a couple fun questions to round us out. Just say the first thing that comes to mind. Super easy. You can wave a wand and have a medicine cure for anything. Mm-hmm. What do you pick?
Cerebral palsy.
What's your superpower?
Wow. My superpower? I think it's resilience.
What's something that maybe you're not so good at that you want to improve at, either professionally or outside of the job in your personal life?
Cooking.
Cooking, okay. What's something you were obsessed with as a child?
Oh, stethoscopes.
Stethoscopes, okay.
Yes.
Let's go back to the physician
grandfather. Yes, yes,
I heard you love to dance.
Yes,
what was your
do.
Preferred musical genre?
Well, I've studied Kathak, and so I love Indian classical music.
And who should I interview next? Whose stories should I go?
I think you should get Sue Desmond-Hens.
Okay.
Yeah,
I think you should. I will tell her you suggested her.
Yes.
Awesome. Sarah, this is amazing. Thank you so much.
Thank you for inviting me. Yeah, it was wonderful.
That's it for this episode of Transcribed. If you enjoyed the conversation, be sure to subscribe. To nominate future guests, drop us a note at transcribed@benchling.com. See you next time.